Good day again, everyone. In this interview, I'm pleased to introduce to you Dr. Stephen Ratcliffe, who has been the director of the Family Practice Residency at Lancaster General Hospital since 2002. As almost all of our listeners know, the residency has a long and hallowed history dating back to the founding of the American Board of Family Practice in 1969. In that same year, with the evolution of the field of general practice into family practice, Dr. Nick Zervanos became the first full-time director of what became the Family Medicine Residency Program at Lancaster General Hospital. Under his leadership, supported by superb teaching carried out by the full-time faculty as well as by LGH staff physicians in private practice, the residency in family practice became one of the most well-known and sought-after in the country, considered by many to be without peer. The residency has had a tremendous impact on healthcare in our community. Of the more than 350 graduates since 1969, 150, almost half, have remained to practice or teach in our service area. And 30 to 35 have become faculty members in other residency programs, including 7 graduates in the last 15 years who have been acting or serving as program directors. To build on this tradition, when Nick Zervanos retired in 2002, Lancaster General was fortunate to entice Dr. Stephen Ratcliffe to take over the reins as the second director of the residency program. Steve is a native of West Virginia and a 1979 graduate of Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. He completed his family practice training at the University of Utah in 1982 and received a Master of Science in Public Health there in 1987. During those years, he began his rise through the academic ranks, and he became family practice division chief at the University of Utah from 1993 to 1998, and then residency program director from 1998 until he came to Lancaster in 2002. He has extensive research experience in low birth weight prevention, smoking cessation in pregnancy, and postpartum depression. His lengthy curriculum vitae lists too many distinctions to recount. I'll only mention that he has served as senior editor of the textbook Family Practice Obstetrics and has contributed a dozen book chapters to textbooks and practice manuals. His current interests include promotion and development of comprehensive health care for indigent populations and strengthening evidence-based medicine. He and his wife, Anita, have 5 children who range in age from 11 to 24. Steve, thank you so much for being with us today and welcome to the journal microphone.
It is my pleasure to be here today.
Well, let me start by asking you to give us sort of a snapshot of the residency as it is today. How many full-time faculty do you have?
We have 23 full-time faculty, and a little bit of a breakdown is indicated. We have of the 23, we have 2 psychologists, 4.5 obstetrician gynecologists, and that leaves us with something like 17 family physician faculty members.
I'm not going to check your math, so I assume you got that right. Now, what about the LGH, a voluntary medical staff? How many of the LGH staff participate in your teaching programs?
I did a calculation of that, anticipating that I would be asked that, and approximately 150 of LGH staff physicians play roles, whether it be radiology, cardiology, pediatrics, internal medicine. And it takes a large village of community physicians to train our program.
Have they generally been the same people over the years? Is there a lot of turnover, or once people are engaged, they stay with it?
The majority of people stay engaged and stay the course. Occasionally, we will have a community physician who, for their own very personal and practical reasons, say that they need to shift gears and de-emphasize their teaching. But at the same time, I have the great fortune of being frequently contacted by people saying, I want to do more, or I used to do more, and I've kind of decreased my involvement. I would like to re-up and get reinvested. And I'm thinking over the last 4 to 5 months, I have been contacted by 4 or 5 different individuals representing orthopedics, college medicine, urology, neurology, and individuals saying, so, I want to do more.
Is there a waiting list? I mean, if people want to do more, can they? Or
I would. These are some of the most pleasant activities in my life when I am sought out in the current circumstance where we are, people saying, I want to do more.
And you work, you're able to
and
work.
And in every situation we've said, boy, do we have a deal for you.
Okay. Well, I would think that there are people listening to this who might be interested to know that. Now, how big is the residency? How many positions do you have?
We have 13 residents per year, so a total of 39 residents in training. We also have 2 fellowships. We have a faculty development fellowship, a fairly unique model of that individual doing about 50% of his or her time as a junior faculty member, and the other half we tailor make it to meet what their faculty development needs.
So that's a fourth year.
That's a fourth year position. And we have 2 to 3 geriatric fellows a year. And we have at least 2 other fellowships that are on the drawing boards. A little too premature to say that it's with certainty going to happen, but we're certainly exploring a couple of other areas as well.
Now, clearly people can enter a family practice residency straight out of medical school, but do people sometimes come to you through different pathways?
The common pathway is for the U.S. grads right out of medical school, as we'll discuss in a little while. Primary care in the United States has become very diversified because of the supply of U.S. medical students not at all beginning to meet the need or the available training spots in family medicine and internal medicine, less so in pediatrics. But in internal medicine, family medicine, the last 7-8 years, there has been the other very prominent player would be the international graduate. And so we will have people that are not, that will have maybe fully trained in hematology oncology in China or in internal medicine in Japan, and then making the transition to this country and retooling, restarting a 3-year family medicine training
program. Now, what percentage of your residents are through those international pathways?
Well, it has changed dramatically in the last couple of years. I think historically it might be 5 or 10% be the occasional international graduate. If you look nationally in the United States right now, in this past match year, somewhere between 40 and 50% of all the spots in family medicine are taken by international graduates. In our program currently, about 20% of our overall resident pool, it comes from international sources.
Now, I think the next obvious question that everybody will want me to ask you is, what percentage of your international graduates are staying in the United States, and how many go back, and how does their actual behavior coincide with their expressed intentions?
The great majority of our international graduates are U.S. citizens. They fully plan to be here. The exception to that would be if we have an international graduate who comes in what is called a J-1 visa. J-1 visa is, for the most part, they're here to train and go back
yes,
to their
home
country.
The famous J-1 visa.
Yeah. There are a few ways that a J-1 visa in working in an underserved area, but for the most part, their intention is to go back. Most of our international graduates are, in fact, U.S. citizens, plan to be here. When you look at physician distribution in the country, and particularly for primary care physicians such as family physicians, There's a very significant number, I would estimate as much as 30-40% in rural and underserved areas that are international graduates, and they're playing a very important health, manpower, women power role in the United States.
Okay. Now, if you take 13 residents each year, how many applicants do you have? I know in my own specialty, cardiothoracic surgery, there has been a dramatic change in applicants. And for the first time this year, the residencies in cardiac surgery in the United States did not fill. Now, some people would say that's good. You have too many anyway, and stents are going to put you out of business. But in fact, of 140 positions, only 120 filled, but only 75 filled with American graduates. Barely more than half. Now, that's a surgical subspecialty. So it's from that perspective that I asked the question.
I'll give you the numbers, and I'll give a little clarification on this. It is a buyer's market for medical students going into primary care and family medicine. So the total number of applicants is one that is markedly different than Nick Cervantes would have encountered 15 years ago, when he would have 200 applicants and might look at 100 of them. This past year, we had approximately 70 bona fide U.S. graduates, which was very good in terms of the marketplace. We had 200 international applicants, and we apply some very strict academic criteria. So of the 200 that wanted to apply, we formally processed approximately 20 of those. And in our final rank list, we had probably a dozen to 15 international graduates, along with probably 65 U.S. graduates. Expand upon that just a little bit. There are 30 family medicine training programs in the state of Pennsylvania, and we have 6 allopathic medical schools. And one of the challenges for all of us in Pennsylvania is what I would consider to be a brain drain outward exodus factor. I don't have the numbers for 06, but in 05, 75% of the allopathic U.S. students training in Pennsylvania, going into family medicine, left the state to do their residency training. So it is a very tight market. And the role of getting the word out and marketing to make sure that the students know of all that we have to offer here at Lancaster General Hospital is a very, very important task that we do very well. But it's
now, have they left the state to train because of the old phenomenon that you're likely to end up practicing where you train and they want to live elsewhere?
I think there are two big factors about the outward migration. One is that 4 of the 6 medical schools are in Philadelphia. Philadelphia is still in the middle of a medical legal crisis where many of the medical school faculty communicate to medical students that medicine is not as much fun as it was in a recent era. And I think that has dramatic impact. There are also the medical schools in Pennsylvania import many students from the West Coast. Penn State at Hershey, Drexel, Temple have a significant number of their
geographically diverse.
Right. They recruit
body.
These students in,
and then they
and
go
I
back.
Think a lot of them want to go back home. Yeah. So I think there are some factors of wanting to not stay in the environment. I will say, in a very positive sense, this is a wonderful part of the world to live in and around the Lancaster area, and one of our strongest recruiting tools are looking at Franklin and Marshall graduates, Elizabethtown graduates, Penn State graduates. And this particular year in our incoming class, four of our 13 residents have very strong local tie for them.
Well, let me ask you what you came here intending to accomplish. What did you feel needed to be done, and how did your advanced perceptions correlate with what you have found?
And an opportunity to direct a program like Lancaster General Family Medicine Program is not one that comes along very often. And in fact, I was not looking at other jobs around the country. When I investigated the program here, I saw that I thought that I would be a very good match for the very high bar, high standards that Nick and his colleagues have set in terms of educational program and a dual emphasis on care of the medically underserved. That I spent 20 years in a federally funded community health center. That has been my passion in terms of doing practice-based research quality improvement in that setting. And that I thought it was a very good fit for what Nick and the folks here had created.
Let me segue for a minute, because it strikes me with the focus that you have and that the residency has on addressing the needs of the underserved. Do you find or do you believe that the residents that you produce are more committed to providing those services after they're out in the real world?
They do, and they do it for several reasons. There is a culture, there is an ethos about this program that is different than many others, and it is one that they actually goes all the way back to 1970 when this program was started. There was an initial commitment to community health and community service that was right here at the beginning of the program. In fact, we require that every resident does a longitudinal community service project, and I'm not aware of that being a requirement in any other program. It's required, and our residents embrace that. They know it coming in. So we have a recruiting bias for folks that are choosing medicine and family medicine for the greater purpose.
So you think it sticks?
And it sticks. And then they get an opportunity to do it. I can talk to you about recent data, and that is graduates over the first 3 years that I was here in tracking our resident graduates. About 50% of them have been staying here locally, which is a little better than what we've done mm-hmm. since the beginning. In the last 2 years, 75% are staying here locally, which says a lot about Lancaster County and Lancaster General Hospital and primary care being very family medicine.
That is a tremendous message.
But of our residents who left the state, fully 50% of them chose a rural or a medically underserved site as their first practice. So I'm very proud of the people that are staying here. I'm also very proud of our graduates that are going to the Zuni Pueblo and starting a new community health center in West Plains, Missouri, and going to a frontier site in Wyoming and a community health center in Rochester, New York. Those are four recent graduates that immediately come to mind. Yeah. So we attract those folks, and we give them the full set of biomedical and also, I think, some of the attitudinal and psychosocial skills to do well in those type of settings.
Yeah. Well, we could go on all day, but I'm going to ask you only one other major thing. And then I think we'll wind it up. And that is, I know of your interest in research activities, and I just would ask if you could outline what major energies you've directed towards that area in terms of, and what resources you've committed in terms of faculty and money and so on.
I'm delighted to address that question. I look at our patient practices as a laboratory that allow us to do things better in care processes. I received a wonderful opportunity to do 4 weeks of training in continuous quality improvement with Intermountain Healthcare in the 1996, bringing all that to the table, and in talking to Nick Servano, is the one part of the triangle that Nick wanted to put in place is one that I shared was developing a research infrastructure in the program. I negotiated when I came here that after being here 2 years that I would begin to get the internal resources to do that. In our incoming class, we have two individuals who in part chose our program because of the research infrastructure. Yesterday, we had 13 third-year residents present their longitudinal research in continuous quality improvement. To top it off, the Louise von Hess Foundation has seen fit to transfer the assets of the foundation to create the Louise von Hess Research Institute, which will benefit the entire LGH family, a portion of which is the Family Medicine Health Research Center located in the institute.
Well, that's a tremendous overview. We could obviously go on talking all day here, but I think we've hit the high notes, and I'm just going to wind it up by saying thank you, and we're going to have to get you, of course, to get your people to write an article for the print journal about how to do research in a clinical practice environment. So thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.